For me, it started in September 2003 when I read an article in The Guardian by Michael Meacher, who had recently been sacked by Tony Blair as an environment minister. And he was arguing in that article that the 9/11 attacks could not have happened if there had not been a US government stand down of defence forces that morning. Now, I found that quite a shocking thing to say, and I was by no means convinced that he was right. But then a friend contacted me and said there was a group of people interested in this subject getting together in London. So I went along to their first meeting in February 2004. And I got involved then, and I've stayed with it ever since, largely working on the organisational side and trying to help the movement to grow. Why do I think it is important? I think it's an important issue because it has been used as a justification to start an apparently endless imperialist war, to erode our civil liberties progressively, and to advance a fascistic agenda throughout much of the Western world. I also think it is important because if we can prove that we have been lied to about 9/11, we can then remove the justification for war, for the war on terror. The justification for the war on terror will just crumble, and so will the fascistic agenda. Therefore, I think that everyone who is sincere should at least look at this issue, should examine this issue with as open a mind as you can possibly muster. I know it's terribly easy to say what I said to myself when I first heard about this idea. They'd never do that. God's sake, they'd never get away with it. Well, I have been convinced otherwise. I'm just going to say a little bit more about our campaign growth. It started in the United States, naturally, where people started asking questions. In this country, as I say, in February 2004, there was just a London group at first. And then we discovered a group up in the north, in Cumbria, that had arisen quite independently. We discovered each other. And then gradually the whole thing began to spread all over the country. We had a sponsored tour by an American millionaire philanthropist called Jimmy Walter, who put on, he brought a whole lot of American researchers across the Atlantic, and he put on events in 8 European cities in order to give publicity to the notion that 9/11 was an inside job and we've been badly lied to about this. Now, I just want to finish with something about the structure of this movement. We have no membership. If you wish to support the notion that 9/11 needs re-examining, then you are a supporter of our movement. It's just as simple as that. We also operate on a no endorsement principle. That means that I may say something which you think sounds silly. I'm not talking on behalf of the movement, though. I'm talking in my own capacity. And when you speak about it, you are talking in your own capacity. And that's what we all do. Because we won't all agree with each other on what, certainly we will not agree with each other on what really happened on that day. There are many theories around. And finally, I'd just like to dialogue a little bit about this. On the 11th of September 2001, was there a conspiracy?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Does anyone say there was not a conspiracy? Okay, what is a conspiracy? Anyone got a definition? Yes, go on, Leah.
Two people or more getting together to plan something that's illegal or criminal.
Right, so that undoubtedly happened whether we think it was organised by Osama bin Laden or not. Yeah? There was a conspiracy, yeah? Okay. Now, there are many theories about what happened. So would we be correct in calling the theory that these attacks were carried out by 19 Arab hijackers under the command of Mohammed Atta and inspired by Osama bin Laden? Would we call, is it correct to call that theory a conspiracy theory?
Yes.
It is. Everybody agrees with that. Good. Yes. Okay. And if we say, oh, I don't believe that, I don't think it's true, does that make me a conspiracy theorist? I say I don't know what happened, but I don't believe the story we've been told. So am I a conspiracy theorist?
No.
Thank you. Right, I'll hand over to Ian.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay. That's going to be a hard act to follow, Noel, in terms of clarity. I'm actually sort of maybe coming from a slightly more academic direction, and what I've prepared tonight are notes that I would want to address the leaders of the various left-wing groups in Britain and America, should they be so kind as to come and listen. There may even be one or two people from left-wing groups here. That was the what we said on our leaflets. I'll start off with a little by way of introduction. I think one thing we can all agree about, and which some of us in the 9/11 skeptic movement were aware of pretty early on, I think we're all very worried about the American Empire. I think we now recognise that there is an American Empire. I think the defining moment for me was when Charles Krauthammer in the New York Times, a very right-wing guy, proudly talked about the American Empire in the wake of 9/11. So I think what we probably have in common, I hope we have in common, is that we're very concerned about the American Empire. Just in case nobody noticed, the Congress recently passed a law whereby any American citizen can now be seized, unless this law is struck down by the Supreme Court, it may be, can now be seized by, on the orders of George Bush, or presumably any of his agents. They can be thrown without any right to any hearing into anywhere that George Bush chooses to put them. They can be held indefinitely with no appeal, and they can be tortured. There are some types of torture which they're not allowed to do, although how anybody would ever know whether they committed that act of torture or not is another question, because they wouldn't have any access to any serious legal remedy. That could be cast down by the Supreme Court. But there again, the guy, you know, the swing vote on the Supreme Court could die as poor Paul Wellstone did in a small plane crash. He might die of a heart attack, as Robin Cook did. So, you know, I draw no conclusions from those incidents, but I would say we're one small plane crash away from the abolition of the American Constitution. And I think that's a matter of grave concern. How has this arisen? There is some debate about this. I don't think many people can seriously dispute that this has arisen as a result of the 9/11 attacks. I buttonholed Mark Seddon, who I would say is, you know, one of the luminaries of the establishment left, although, you know, many people would describe him as on the left wing of the Labour Party. He is on the left wing of the Labour Party. I said, Mark, you know, surely you must admit that, you know, this couldn't have happened without 9/11. And he thought for a bit, and he said, no, he said, I think they'd have got their war anyway. Well, I disagree, and I think most people disagree. Certainly the mainstream commentator elite in America disagrees, and certainly the 9/11 Commission disagreed. They said very clearly in their judgment, and of course we don't believe everything they say, but they don't have much reason, an axe to grind here. They said none of this would have been possible without the 9/11 attacks. The invasion of Iraq, I think they said, was unthinkable without the 9/11 attacks. So those are two things that I think we probably all have in common. Lately, there's been two developments in the movement that I'd just like to briefly mention. One is lobbying of the Green Party in the UK and the Green Party in America has led to majority support now in both groups as measured by votes at their general meeting in England of the Green Party, that they were calling now for a reinvestigation of 9/11. It's quite significant. There's a lot of Green Party candidates in America standing very absolutely specifically. Their main issue is reopen 9/11. Now that the Green Party's on board, newspapers that are sympathetic in Britain have at least got some politicians who've got the guts to be quoted. Up to now, it's only been Michael Meacher, and he's been running away from everybody for the last 2 years. I mean, if you're on the Daily Mail, who've been extremely good on the 9/11 issue, you know, you can't find a politician having the guts to even raise any issues to put any quotes into the mouth of, you know, and this is how it works, frankly. Probably more significant was the article that appeared in the Washington Post around the anniversary of 9/11. A lot of 9/11 skeptics didn't really notice this because, you know, it did put the case in favour of the official story. But the spectacular thing about that article, and I'm not an optimist, and I have been reading the media for many years now, the spectacular thing about the Washington Post article was that it was completely even-handed. It did not mock, it did not abuse, there were no lies in it, unlike the Guardian article that came out on a similar theme. Sloppy, badly researched, couple of straightforward errors of fact, nasty little snidey comments about 9/11 skeptics. The Washington Post article was not of that ilk. It was saying, we've got a serious problem here, guys. The Washington Post speaks to the American establishment. That article was saying to anybody who had the sensitivity, who operates in Washington, it was saying, we've got a serious problem here, guys. This story will not stand up. We're going to have to go back and we're going to have to completely restart this, and we're going to have to start by addressing the 40% of Americans, that is 40% of Americans, by several different opinion polls have come out with similar figures, who do not believe the official story of the 9/11 attacks. Now, conspiracist theorists, you know, in the sociology world who, you know, are quoted by newspapers will tell you that, you know, American rednecks, you know, will believe anything. You know, they're deeply skeptical of government because they see lots of guys making a lot of money and they're really poor living in the Appalachians and they're really ill-informed, you know, and they gossip with each other and they decide the government's to blame for everything. And that's why people don't believe the official story about the 9/11 attacks. It won't wash. It's not true. I'm sure if you did a detailed poll, you would find that the people who disbelieve the 9/11 attacks are well-educated people who get their information from the internet. And yes, you know, Daily Mail readers who do think that all politicians are crooks, and who can gainsay that, I think. So those are two, you know, interesting developments. Just by way of introduction, I'd like to make one point which I think permeates this debate, the debate between 9/11 believers and 9/11 skeptics, and that is the issue of proof. What constitutes proof? Now, in a court of law, there are two types of trial. There are trials, criminal trials, where you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that somebody is guilty. And then there are civil hearings where you have to prove on a balance of probability. Now, I would like to suggest that one reason why we're actually, to some extent, in a dialogue of the deaf on this issue is because the people who believe the official story, often people who work in the media who are going to have their articles vetted by libel lawyers, for instance, people who believe the official story are basically saying, we need something that will prove beyond any doubt that Tony Blair and George Bush did it. Now, that is an extremely high threshold. You know, revisiting the Watergate, you know, nobody really believed. You know, the clinching thing that got Nixon in Watergate, I lived through this, was when the Watergate tapes came out. And actually, the thing that really did Nixon in was that he swore the thing that, you know, all the talking heads said, oh, you know, this proves da 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 what Ehrlichman said to Sloane, said da 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 da. Rubbish. What the ordinary American public caused them to abandon Nixon was when the religious bloc, the small c conservatives, discovered that Nixon used swear words. It was the deletives expleted in the Watergate transcripts that sunk Nixon. So let's, you know, I'm just putting a few points of political reality here. Now, I'm not here tonight to address the issue of how the towers collapsed, why there isn't more wreckage at the Pentagon, etc., etc. No doubt, you know, that will come up during the course of the evening. I'm here to talk about why establishment figures in the left and anywhere else should be prepared to raise questions about the 9/11 attacks and how they might do that. So it's going to be maybe what, you know, a little bit boring to people who, those of us who are very interested in how the towers collapsed. I'm going to briefly define what we mean by the left. I'm going to describe three different categories of people who you might call on the left. I'm then going to explain what our political action plan is, and as Noel said, I say us, I guess I mean we, I guess I mean I, because the movement has no speakers, official speakers. The campaign is different from the movement. The campaign simply says we want to reopen the issue of what happened in the 9/11 attacks. And really, this is a meeting on behalf of the campaign rather than on behalf of the movement. And then I'm going to list the actual points. I thought, well, a lot of people on the left, especially the academic left, they start with the theory, you know, they start with the philosophy, they go on to the theory, and then finally they get down to the facts. Now, you know, for a lot of us, we go the other direction. You know, we look at the facts, and then we figure out which theory fits best fits the facts, but I'm going to do it this way. What do we mean by the left? I think the left nowadays, you know, has been in a state of crisis for some time. We all believe in social justice. I consider myself to be on the left, although I'm a small businessman by way of how I earn my money. But we believe in social justice. We believe that everybody's got to get together to confront certain common problems that we have in the world today, and particularly, you know, the most obvious one is the climate problem, the climate change problem. There are many other problems as well, starvation, war, etc. Those have been around for a long time. But the one that nobody can avoid is the climate change problem. However rich you are, we're all breathing the same air. And we're concerned about the global elite. I think, you know, there was a time 20 years ago when if you talked about the global elite, you know, people might have thought you were a really hard-line, you know, Marxist. But I just would mention that there was an article in the New York Times recently which was about inequality. And they analysed the change in wealth in America since between 1980 and 2000. This is from memory. I hope I don't get any of these facts wrong. Roughly 1980, roughly 2000. Now, we all know, you know, that the... many of us know that the poorer people in America, by some measures, their standard of living has actually gone down since 1980. I think that's fairly well known to social scientists. The interesting thing in the New York Times article was that they looked at where that wealth had gone, where the increase in wealth had gone. Now, probably most people would say, I certainly thought, that that had gone to probably the top 10%. When I went to university and did social studies, you know, that was the figure. Nobody really looked beyond the top 10%. It was the top 10% that was arguably going to get richer or poorer, and you were trying to redistribute. No, the top 10% had not, well, the top 9%, the top 1%, all that increase in wealth had gone to the top 1%. You know, possibly even fewer than that. The next 9% were doing no better than anybody else. They had been relatively, hugely left behind by the top 1%. Now, you know, I went back to Oxford. That rings, you know, true with me. I went back to Oxford and met an old friend of mine recently. You tend to meet the sort of failures who go back. You know, the high flyers are all busy in London, you know, talking to bankers and diplomatic circles in Washington and things. So the relative failures. But I met my old friend Jim. He was in a big company, but he wasn't on the board. And my goodness, Jim was as left-wing and angry as he's ever been. He said that, you know, we workers up there on the sort of head of section level in big companies, we're getting screwed by those bastards on the board. He said, I'm only on 50,000. These guys are taking millions home. I do all the work. You know, these guys are screwing me. So, you know, we are in a very different world from the world of even 20 years ago. You know, we've got the American Constitution hanging by a thread. We've got, you know, a global elite that only the most wild-eyed Marxists, you know, dreamt about, really, certainly in my youth. And so anyway, I think that's where we are, you know, where we might all have some consensus here. Now we get to the thorny question of different types of left. So we've got the populist stroke anarchist left, and that is basically the driving motor of the 9/11 truth movement. It's the people who don't trust leaders, especially not any leaders we've got around at the moment in the establishment. But, you know, they're not big on dogma. They think they're just ordinary people, basically, who happen to be left-wing. Then we've got the global left, and that's, in a sense, the most interesting. Obviously, the most high-profile member of the global left at the moment is Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And it might be worth mentioning that Hugo Chavez, unlike Noam Chomsky, and they were shoulder to shoulder only a few years ago at the Global Forum, but Hugo Chavez has now said the hypothesis that the towers were brought down by explosives is not absurd. So, you know, there is movement here in that area of the global left as well, of the left as well. And, you know, anecdotal evidence suggests that, you know, outside US, UK, and particularly outside Europe, very few people actually do believe in the official story of 9/11 any longer. Certainly in the Islamic world, there's been opinion polls taken. I found myself being interviewed on the South African radio station, which was apparently beamed all over Africa, you know, and they just took it as a complete joke that anybody would still believe in the official story of the 9/11 attacks. How representative they were, I can't say. So that's the global left. Now we get to the problem. That's what I call the academic theological left. And these are the people who are in the universities. They're very authoritarian in their attitude. I heard an apocryphal story, maybe true, I heard this recently, that, you know, when Media Lens, which is a very well-respected website, and I would have a lot of praise for Media Lens on many subjects, but the story goes that they phoned up Herman or Chomsky or somebody who were their gurus, you know, so to speak, up the chain of command, and they said, oh no, don't touch the 9/11 truth movement, you know, it's going to poison our well of purity. And, you know, Media Lens to this day, you know, range from being, you know, cold to being downright abusive towards anybody in the 9/11 truth movement. We had a most unpleasant email exchange with them when my book was published. So, you know, this is the left of the alpha males. This is the left that many people would say wrecked the populist left, you know, during the 20th century, by factionalism, by ego. And I think for a lot of people on that left, not all, you know, not at all, but for a lot of them, they sort of see the 9/11 truth movement as a sort of competitive faction. You know, now it's not just the Workers' Revolutionary Party and the SWP, it's the 9/11 truth movement. So everybody's sort of, you know, in true tradition, you know, slags everybody else off because they're all trying to get each other's activists into their groups, you know. I mean, maybe I'm being too negative. Interestingly, the World Socialist website, which wsws.org, I think, they're brilliant, you know, they're very, very good, you know, conventional Marxist analysis, which actually, you know, is very convincing in arguing that not only the 9/11 attacks, but a whole range of activities, and of course, particularly in Europe, you know, people with long memories will think of the Gladio issue, where it turned out that the Red Brigades in Italy, and possibly also the second generation Baader-Meinhof group in Germany had actually been infiltrated by the secret police and turned against the first generation and turned into a madly destructive and criminally murderous group, so as to well, actually, they went on to murder Aldo Moro. Anyway, that's another story. So that's the left who really, you know, perhaps I've been a bit rude about them, but that's the left who really, I think, you know, we need, all the rest of us need to address if we do want to talk to the left. These guys have muscle, you know. They can get into the Guardian comment pages. They just have to put a, the right guy puts a phone call through. I was trying for ages to get a piece in the Guardian opinion pages, and I said to somebody, how come they ran Michael Meacher? Oh, we had a word with Jeremy Corbyn. He said he'd get something done, and 3 days later Michael Meacher was in the Guardian. You know, so they've got power, these people. It's well worth getting them on our side. They're well organised. They'd have had big signs up for this meeting. There'd have been a good sound system here. You know, they've had twice as many people come. They might not have been as interesting people, and they might not have listened as carefully, but they would have had twice as many people. You know, I think it is well worth addressing them. So let's now get on to... that was the stick. Now let's get on to the carrot. This is what I propose... And I think, you know, we're all pretty much in harmony on this in the 9/11 Truth campaign in Britain and America as how we are going to stop, not by ourselves, but how we're going to contribute to the stopping and the overthrow of the oligarchy, which is currently attempting to establish a gruesome empire through the American agency of the American government and the Pentagon.
Can you speak up a bit?
I'm sorry. If I point over a little bit. Are people at the back having trouble hearing?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. I've got a bug, actually, and I'm just a bit worried my voice is going to go. Maybe if I speak up a bit. Is that any better? Is that any better?
Well, stand up and we can hear you a bit better.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it?
Can you sit in the middle of the room or something, then?
Come sit on the desk.
Is that any better from here?
Yes.
Is it? Okay, right. I was just a bit worried about this little mic thing. This is going out on the web. I do hope I don't think it's too seditious. It's all being recorded. Okay, so this is basically the plan. Under the radar, we give out DVDs showing actually what happened visually in the 9/11 attacks. And I think probably the most dramatic... Well, no, there's a couple of things which you'll see if you ever look at one of these DVDs. And on the physical side, it shows the collapse of World Trade Center 6. Now, I'd said I wouldn't get into all these details... World Trade Center 7, excuse me. I said I wouldn't get into these, you know, forensic details. Suffice it to say that, you know, it's very hard to look at that happening and imagine that it all just happened by some sort of structural problem. It just goes... You know, in pretty much free fall time. I'd just like to digress there and say that I did do a science degree, and there is such a thing as the law of conservation of momentum. And when a building falls, it encounters structural resistance, which may be very low if you've got a theory about how it's falling, and then it also encounters inertial resistance. So even if there's no structural resistance, you've got an inertial resistance which will slow down the collapse. So anyway, Building 7 just goes... Whoosh. And the other interesting thing on these DVDs that I will mention even in this context is that the media on the morning of 9/11, I'm going to go back to this, but in the morning of 9/11, they actually said that there were explosions. There wasn't actually a lot of doubt that the towers had collapsed. And, you know, you can see the stuff replayed. They can't change, you know, they can't delete it any longer now. They're doing their best to censor the current broadcast media, but it's there on the record. They're all saying it. You know, Dan Rather,
Are you saying this building collapsed as a result of explosions? Yes. Explosions set in the buildings? Yes. You've got this sort of dialogue going on in the mainstream media, you know. When they, of course, because they thought it was Bin Laden that put all the bombs in, you know, when they realised that that couldn't possibly be made to stand up, suddenly the story changed. Oh, no explosions. You know, it's a conspiracy theory. Anyway, we put out these DVDs below the radar, and that's brilliant. You know, the phase one of that's been going on for 3-4 years now, and it's had a huge success. That's how we've got the 40% doubters. It's the networking on the internet and the DVDs. Meanwhile, over the radar, we say, oh, you know, there's a lot of doubt about what's been happening, and I'm going to mention what I think we might want to say, or I'm going to suggest that we should be saying. But we want an investigation. Now, this is, of course, the nub. Because as one of our opponents at the Green Party said, I don't believe in investigations. Look what happened to the Hutton report. Very good point. We don't just want a Hutton-type investigation. But first of all, we want to get the idea established that a new investigation is needed. That's pretty much been done in America, actually, by now. But in the words of the American Green Party, we want it to be new, which means it is not going to just start off with the 9/11 Commission and sort of relaunder the 9/11 Commission. It's going to be a new investigation by new people asking new questions to the witnesses. It's going to be independent. Now, that is what we are then going to say once we've got that established. And they say, oh, well, Lord Hutton's maybe a little bit compromised. Let's get his mate, Lord Sutton, who sits next to him in the House of Lords. We're going to say, bullshit. We want it really independent. We don't want anybody from the House of Lords. We want somebody from abroad. We'd like a panel. We'd like a neutral like Mubarak. You know, we'd like an anti-American like Chavez. And we'd like an official story supporter. Yeah, you know, if he wants to be on it, Cheney. So, you know, you get the idea. We want it really independent. And, you know, if we do get a groundswell of anger, and this is building up in America, especially as they lose the war, especially as the disasters which Bush has got them into become more and more undeniable, there will be a groundswell of anger, and it will be very difficult for them. You know, we will be picketing. You know, we will not allow a bogus commission to even start anything. You know, we will be sitting in like they did against the Stasi in East Germany by then. So it's going to be independent and it's going to be extended. Now what that means is we are going to look into 9/11 as a criminal act of mass murder. Who can deny that 9/11 was a criminal act of mass murder? That's how dangerous the position is of the American elite who are trying to push this and have basically probably already failed, I think history will judge. They tried to pretend it was an administrative issue, and they've got away with it for quite a long time. But we are going to say, no, it was a criminal act of mass murder, and therefore it requires all the force and power of the criminal law. And one of the phrases that we might want to use, which Senator Barbara Boxer recently used, you know, we're not talking street corner rabble-rousers here, like me, maybe. We're talking, you know, serious people with very wise thinking. We want to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And as the evidence comes out, we will then put it onto the media, because one of the conditions of this inquiry is it is going to have direct access to the media. Not too much to ask for there. Maybe we'll even have managed to get rid of get the media owners out of play by then and actually liberate the journalists to actually tell the truth. I mean, it has happened in the past. Maybe it was as long ago as Watergate. But, you know, it can happen. We're not talking anything, you know, that is completely fanciful here. And then, as the evidence comes out, then, you know, gradually we will follow it wherever it leads. And, of course, you know, in America they've got the RICO Act brought in by Nixon, Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, which means that, you know, of course, we'd be able to threaten these guys with Guantanamo Bay if they don't cooperate. Anyway, you know, maybe we are getting a bit fanciful here. But there is no good reason why this can't happen with the right groundswell of popular anger. And they've left it so late now, too little too late. Remember that from your history lessons. That's how empires fell. That's how regimes are overthrown. Too little too late. They tried, they got too conceited, they went for it, they realised too late it was falling to bits. And then they started making concessions, but each concession just fed the anger, and it was too little, too late, and that's what's going to happen. The Washington Post has come up with its article saying that we must reinvestigate the 9/11 attacks. Much, much too late. The evidence now, which we're not going to particularly discuss tonight, is so overwhelming that once you can remove this hugely high threshold of beyond reasonable doubt and to convict a politician, reasonable doubt at the moment is taken to be absolutely stupendously high. You know, we are still living in the after the sacking of Greg Dyke, the sacking of Piers Morgan. They're running scared in the media, of course they are. You know, let's have a little bit of sympathy for the honest ones. It's very hard to tell which are the honest ones, but you know, let's have a bit of sympathy for them. So there we are. That's the action plan. That's the carrot for the left and for everybody else. One thing I should mention as well, quite an important point this actually. What stopped Vietnam was not the left. The left was a participant in what stopped Vietnam, but it was not the only participant. The other elements were the libertarians and the conservatives. So it was a tripartite alliance. The left, who were against the American Empire and anti-colonialists, the conservatives, who just thought that the Vietnamese should be allowed to get on with their own lives and what on earth was America doing interfering, and who harked back to the Constitution and remembered that they too were a revolutionary society who had thrown off a foreign yoke. And that is still actually still a very live idea in America, although the Bush people, and in conjunction with the Brits, are trying to recolonize America at the moment, possibly without success, we hope. So we've got those other threads, and this is why I am a little bit worried sometimes about the academic left, because, you know, they need to face reality. It was not them that stopped the Vietnam War. It was this very broad coalition of small-c conservatives. This was the same coalition, actually, which stopped Hitler. In those days, it was called, what did they call it in Russia? They called it patriotic and socialist movement or something like that. The patriotic, that's a sort of euphemism, you know, code word for small c conservative. It's the same thing. And, you know, we have to make common cause with the small c conservatives if we're going to stop this. Obviously, you know, it's tricky. Nobody's asking George Galloway to start, you know, enthusiastically making friends with Peter Hitchens. But in the end, you know, those two constituencies are already working together in the States. Believe me, antiwar.com, for instance, a very influential website. John Pilger writes on it. Some, you know, people who you never would imagine John Pilger would share a platform for also write on it. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He's quite a clever guy, actually. Anyway, so that's, you know, that's how we're going to do it. We're not going to have nasty little squabbles about how many angels can dance on the end of the head of a pin, you know, whether what happened in Kronstadt in 1919, all that garbage. We're going to get it together because we've got much too much of a threat at the moment. That threat is very, very clear. Okay, so that takes me through to, I'm not sure which order to do this in, actually. I think I'll do it with, I'll next go to what we can say above the radar. Now, let's forget about our dreams, my dreams, you know, for the future. Let's just return to the present. We've got a very, very wobbly situation. We've got, you know, a media which is still very, very cowed. We've got an army that's losing a war. And can you imagine what it's like to be the producer of Newsnight? You know, if you go a little bit too far, you're going to have squatters ringing up saying, "You fucking bastard! You know, you're maligning my friends. You know, we're going to get you. You know, it's a very difficult situation. It can go either way. It's wobbling. Until the war's clearly ended in defeat, I don't think actually we will see a lot of visible progress on the official level. All we're really doing now is eroding it from inside with our below the radar activities, and we're preparing the ground for the crisis which is going to come when the war ends. you know, I believe, I have a friend who's a historian, he tells me that, you know, that that is always when things go badly wrong, when wars end in defeat, you know, it's very bad news, always has been, and it won't be any different this time. Sorry, but when wars end in defeat, you know, that's when the ruling class, you know, or the elite, or whatever you like to call it, is at its wobbliest. And I mean, there's a story, you know, from the First World War. I don't know how true this is. It has been reported as fact that after the First World War, you know, with Russia falling to the communists and Germany threatened by a communist putsch, Lloyd George called in the trade unionists and he said, "Gentlemen, you can rule this country. You know, I give up. You know, I'm a nobody now. I'm exposed as being the bastard who led us into this barbarous war. It's all yours, gentlemen." And the trade unionists, according to this story, basically said, "Well, we've got no idea how to run the country. You know, you better keep doing it for a year or two." A year or two later, it was too late. They got reorganized, general strike, soldiers, you know, all over. You've got to move fast when the war ends. That's the moral of the story. And you've got to be ready with the right demands. And the way to move against the system, let's just remember those small c conservatives, it's the law. That's their big, that's their Achilles heel. This was a mass murder. A lot of people are now complicit in it. We're not talking about overthrowing people because they're rich and we don't like them. You know, we're talking about putting people in jail because they are complicit in a mass murder, and that is quite, you know, a few at the top. And then there's an awful lot of other people who are accessories to mass murder. And what one quite important minor sort of thing that the 9/11 movement and 9/11 campaign is saying is, every time anybody approaches somebody in the establishment, keep a record. When a journalist goes to an editor and say, "I've got a good story here, I don't understand how World Trade Center 7 could have collapsed," and the editor says, "We're not covering that, these people are friends of ours," keep a record, because that guy is arguably an accessory. He certainly needs questioning to a mass murder. Of course it's not going to get anywhere now, but just wait. Times change, moods change. Lawyers can be on our side. Lawyers are actually a bastion of the democratic freedoms which are now under challenge. Don't write off lawyers. Don't write off the law. That's how we're going to do it. Because if we do anything more than that, they'll start destabilizing. It'll be, "Oh, you're just a bunch of revolutionaries. You know, you've got to stand up against chaos, blah, 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 blah." We have got the high ground. Okay, so what are the things we can talk about? Just have a quick break here. How long have I been going on for now?
About 35 minutes.
Okay, so probably about another 15 minutes tops, huh? and then questions. That sound, is that about right?
Yeah,
okay.
The bar and the bugs.
Okay.
Everybody.
A break now and then questions?
Can we break now?
Oh. No, you will never get people.
Okay.
Okay, right. Now, here are some of the things we can talk about. I'm not sure if I'm going to have these in logically quite the right order. PNAC, Project for a New American Century. This isn't speculation. It's all down there. I think they made a terrible mistake in publishing this, but they did publish it. They can't unpublish it. And they published a paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses. That is not a very informative title. It's actually about how America can take over the world. And it's all there in black and white, you know. And one of the interesting things it says, there are many interesting things in that paper. One of the interesting things it says is, I'm paraphrasing this, but I don't think you'll find I'm too inaccurate in what I'm saying. We want an army in Iraq, whether or not Saddam Hussein is still in power. Whether or not Saddam Hussein is still in power. There is no issue. You know, forget about Saddam Hussein. It's not about weapons of mass destruction. Of course it wasn't. It's not about Saddam Hussein. It's about projecting American power because, in the words of, I think, Senator Richard Lugar, we have a lifeline. The oil in the Middle East is our lifeline. That's how they see it. Of course, if this was challenged in a proper democratic debate, people would say, well, couldn't we just build windmills? You know, and then they'd have to say, oh yeah, but our friends in the oil companies wouldn't make any money if we just did it with windmills. That wouldn't sound too good, would it? How nice it would be if we did have a democratic debate. We will have a democratic debate at some future point when the war's over. Maybe even before it's over. Who knows? We might even be lucky. So you've got PNAC, Project for a New American Century. One other point about that. Two of the signatures, I believe, I haven't checked this out to put in a book, but I think you'll find that two of the signatures were Condoleezza Rice, no great surprise there. Richard Armitage, touted in the mainstream media as being one of the doves, an ally of Colin Powell, apparently. And most interestingly, from us, with our legal hat on, Philip Zelikow. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I don't know how many people here know who Philip Zelikow is. He was the executive director of the independent 9/11 Commission. How very independent. That's the guy that wanted an American army in Iraq, come what may. Executive director. Cheney. He's the guy who controlled Cheney, of course. Zelikow was the guy who controlled all the research for the 9/11 Commission, independent 9/11 Commission. He was, prior to that, he co-wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice. I know from my bitter experiences with my old friend Roland Morgan what it means to say that somebody co-wrote a book. You've got to be very intimate, and you can still end up hating each other part of the time, I'm afraid to say. So he co-wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice, and he's back in the State Department now. Oh yes, and one other thing I forgot. He sat on the transition team. Philip Zelikow helped to appoint the officials whose alleged incompetence allowed the 9/11 attacks to take place. That is how absurd the independent 9/11 Commission is. That is what anybody can say on Newsnight, anybody can say in The Guardian, nobody can gainsay. That was not an independent commission. Now, let's just get on to another thing about the 9/11 Commission, because this is something which has happened in plain sight. All these things have happened in plain sight. Not a conspiracy theory, not an allegation, a fact on the government record. Now, you might be a bit surprised when I make this statement, but there has never been an investigation into who carried out the 9/11 attacks. Sounds extraordinary, doesn't it? You know, if you said that in the middle of the Today programme, James Knockett, he would say, oh, what are you saying? How could you, you know, blah, de blah. There never has been. I'll tell you why there hasn't and how we can prove that there never has. Because each of the investigations, and there have been several, there's been the Joint Senate House Intelligence Committee's investigation, there's been the independent 9/11 Commission investigation, there's been the NIST investigation into how the Twin Towers collapsed. There's been the FEMA investigation into how the Twin Towers collapsed. There's been the NIST investigation into what happened at the Pentagon. And all those investigations have had expressly in their terms of reference the insistence that no blame should be ascribed to any individual in America. I don't remember the exact how they quite put it. They couldn't have put it quite as crudely and obviously as that. The 9/11 Commission actually commented on it. They said it was part of our... They didn't mention it was actually in their terms of reference. They said, we chose not to bear any blame on any individual in America. Thomas Keane, you know, who's a pretty much an establishment Republican trustee as you can get, even he found that a bit hard to swallow. And he actually had an outburst during the 9/11 Commission sitting, not in the sessions or outside. And he said, you know, people should have been sacked. I don't understand this at all. People should have been sacked. This is just deplorable, you know. And there was a storm, you know, and he retracted it. And, you know, they went back to nobody's to blame. So whereas we have, you know, we don't just have a high threshold, of a presumption of innocence, you know, for anybody in the American establishment, you know. No possibility that there might have been any moles who could have tipped off Al-Qaeda to the hijack exercises that were going on that morning. No possibility that Al-Qaeda could have put anybody... Nobody in America was allowed to be blamed. This is a presumption of innocence gone mad, you know. This is a legalised assertion of innocence. And, of course, on the other side, the other suspects, Bin Laden and his friends, they were presumed guilty. There was no discussion, you know, absolutely none, not one second of discussion at any stage in any of these things that the basic official story, Bin Laden did it, isn't true. Not a whisper. And that's great, you know, that is really good. They were so stupid. You know, why didn't they just pretend to consider that there are some alternative, you know, theories? they are a bit thick, you know. I mean, I'm not one for saying that it's because Bush is, you know, a moron, etc., etc. I think you've got to be quite bright to get to be president, you know, even with the support of your dad. But, you know, it does seem to me to be a terrible miscalculation that they explicitly made a point of insisting. I think it probably shows how weak their case is, actually, you know, how very easily even somebody like Thomas King could have unravelled the whole thing, you know. That's the only explanation I can think for why they did that. But anyway, when you're on Newsnight, when you're trying to get the Guardian to write an article, you know, this is rock solid. They've just got to go back and check the terms of reference for these commissions. It was excluded. There never has been an investigation into who carried out the 9/11 attacks. There has been an investigation into how Bin Laden carried out the 9/11 attacks. Not a very good one. Anyway, point made. Another solid thing. Now, this is sort of possibly, there has been a teeny flaw crept into this in recent weeks. The anthrax attacks. It is not true that after the 9/11 attacks, the whole of the American establishment rallied behind Bush and, you know, they all gung-ho supported the call for a war. That's not true. What is true is that anybody who did call for a genuine investigation and did start making any trouble, you know, called me a conspiracy theorist, but something happened to them, you know. Daschle, anthrax letter. Leahy, anthrax letter. Paul Wellston, small plane crash. There's a couple of, you know, little-known congressional representatives who were suddenly the New York Times. I can't remember the guy's name in New Jersey, but there was a senator from a congressman from New Jersey who raised some very, very apt and aggressive questions. And the New York Times suddenly discovered about this ghastly corruption that the guy was guilty of. I'm sure they were right, you know. But, you know, it was just unfortunate for the truth that the New York Times discovered it just at that moment. Torricelli, I think his name was, and he was out, you know. So you can go through, you know, people did try to question it, and they were, you know, they were got at. The anthrax attacks came, you know, they've managed to sort of insert a tiny bit of doubt into this lately, but basically the FBI determined and the Federation of American Scientists determined that the anthrax attacks could only have come from anthrax that was only available to individuals within the American military industrial complex. You know, now that's bad enough, but the anthrax letters, some of them, were mailed before 9/11. And before 9/11, the anthrax antidote started to be given to some friends of Bush. I think the White House started taking it, presumably because, you know, Senator Daschle's letters could have got mixed up with, I mean, maybe I'm being a bit, you know, over-suspicious here, but anyway, you know, hugely suspicious, the anthrax attacks. After the anthrax attacks, you know, Oklahoma bomb, initially blamed on Arab terrorists. Oh no, it turns out to be American homegrown right-wingers. 9/11 attacks, initially blamed on 9/11 terrorists. Anthrax attacks, initially blamed on 9/11 terrorists. Now, you know, known to be from American right-wing sources. You know, shouldn't somebody have said, well, let's actually ask who did carry out and how they did carry out the 9/11 attacks. So that's the anthrax. No argument about that. It's all public record. I'll go over two or three things a bit faster. 1993 World Trade Center attack. A little bit odd that, wasn't it? You know, they nearly did what they did in 2001. Very close. You know, if that bomb had been a bit nearer the center of the towers, we were told at the time, they'd have come down. Didn't provoke any sort of, you know, wars. One of the reasons for that was because it turned out that, although it was an extremely long and murky story, it's all there on the record in the New York Times. And, you know, those attacks were, the FBI was intimately involved with the 1993 World Trade Center attack. They could have busted the people beforehand. They didn't. There was even a report that the explosives were supplied. In fact, the explosives were supplied by a guy who was working as an agent of the FBI. And the reason we know that was because he tape-recorded all his calls with the FBI handlers and published them afterwards. he was given $1.5 million afterwards. It wasn't quite clear exactly what he did get the $1.5 million for officially, but you know, a lot of people wondered if it was hush money. Not a dicky bird, you know. And then, you know, so some people would say they waited. They nearly got burned on the 1993 attacks. They were getting very close to getting burned. So they thought, we better not try that again. We'll leave it for a while. And then, you know, some people would say they waited 10 years and then they did the 2001 ones. Operation Northwoods, another bit of public record here. The Pentagon plan, to the Daily Mail, when they reviewed my book, they picked on Operation Northwoods as being a really important lead-in to the whole issue. Basically, in 1963, I won't go on at great length about this, the Pentagon had a plan to fake a plane shoot down over Cuba so as to justify the launching of an invasion of Cuba. Now, you know, I personally don't think that the 9/11 attacks were modelled on Operation Northwoods, but what Operation Northwoods shows is that it would actually be possible to fake quite an amazingly complicated thing. You know, I mean, nobody would have suspected it. They had a very clever way of disguising the planes. They were going to swap planes. It was complicated. And they were. And the question, of course, well, everybody was going to ask, where are these people who've allegedly died, these American citizens? Well, what we know about that is that the Pentagon said, we will have people under carefully prepared aliases. And they thought that that would withstand media scrutiny. Even in 1963, you know, when the American media were a lot more independent, there were a lot more free muckraking journalists than there are now. So what we know from Operation Northwoods is that not a mad colonel in the Pentagon basement, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and each of their signatures is on this document. You can see it on the web. They each decided, they all severally and together decided that they could do this, that they could fake a plane shoot down, they could produce fake relatives, or rather the fake survivors of allegedly dead passengers. So, you know, if somebody says, oh, you know, what would they have done with the passengers? And I was asked this, I think, on one of the radio programs I was interviewed on. My answer is, well, I don't know, but it's whatever they were planning to do for Operation Northwoods. And actually, a few investigators have looked into it, and it is quite hard to actually find some of those alleged passengers from the diving. But anyway, let's not go into the details. That's Operation Northwoods, which we can talk about. It's all public record. Just one little detail. People say, oh, you know, they just took advantage of the 9/11 attacks to attack Iraq. Yeah, they wanted to attack Iraq, but, you know, they never could have done. They took advantage of the 9/11 attacks. That's one of the things that, the, you know, a lot of people say. Well, actually, the interesting whistleblower here is not Richard Clarke, who's, you know, quite a dubious guy, and I think probably had something to do with the attacks. The interesting whistleblower, and here we get back to our small C conservatives, is a guy called O'Neill, Paul O'Neill, who was the Treasury Secretary. And he brought out a memoir that was ghosted by a Washington journalist. It's the usual garbage, you know, you don't have to read it all. Backslapping, you know, country club stuff, Washington journalism style. But there's some deadly bits in it. And the really deadly bit is that at the first cabinet meeting after Bush was inaugurated, high on the agenda, and he implies top of the agenda, was how can we attack Iraq? Now, you know, you could say Bush and Cheney are a bunch of bumbling idiots, you know, who would have been thinking about and how lucky they were that 9/11 arrived. I don't think you put a subject which couldn't possibly happen, you know, absent 9/11 at the top of the agenda of a cabinet meeting, you know. They knew they were going to be attacking Iraq. They knew they were going to be getting their excuse, and that's what I suspect. But anyway, it was actually discussed before 9/11. We all know Bush, after 9/11, jumped on Iraq. They were on it before 9/11. Now, this is my last point. I'm not going to go on about what the left says. We can raise that later in question and answer. The best theory about what really happened in 9/11 is Webster Tarpley. I say this as an author on 9/11 myself. this book, he's not 100% right, you know, it should have been better edited, but he's got his theory is the moles and patsies theory. In other words, yeah, bin Laden was around, you know, yes, he possibly thought he was carrying out 9/11, but it was only the moles, the guys at the other side who were manipulating the patsies, who allowed it all to happen. Sounds a little bit complicated. I don't think it is, really. Moles and patsies. So that is really, I think, the paradigm which fits most of the 9/11 theories and has a huge historical basis. You know, you've got Gladio, you've got the Red Brigades in Italy. Again and again and again, you know, dare I say it, Lee Harvey Oswald, I was just the patsy. You know, it's a very common refrain in historical events. It provides a continuity, a theory, if you like, which explains, if not everything, most things. And so then we get on to the final thing, capability. This, I think, is really the Achilles heel, certainly in the media now. This is what I found played best when I was interviewed. The problem with 9/11 is, how did Osama bin Laden, with his little team of guys in their caves and, you know, dreamers and would-be airline pilots, how did he actually successfully carry it out? You know, let's consider, you know, oh, well, he had the great mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's previous operation was an attack on the USS Cole. Not difficult to do. All they had to do was to load up a boat, punt it out to the USS Cole and press a detonator. You know, that's how difficult that was. And actually, the first time they did it, they filled the boat up with too much explosive and it sank. And they waited another 3 months collecting up more explosive, you know. So that's great mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know. Anyway, a little bit of a digression there. Capability. How was Al-Qaeda able to achieve this stupendous, spectacular thing out of the blue? You know, they didn't build up to it like the IRA did. It came out of the blue. They'd never managed anything halfway successful, halfway complicated, but they managed 9/11. Well, the official story had an account of that. As you know, they had an immediate account. 600 sleeper cells in America, $2.3 billion network of terror. That's how they did it, and it was very credible. Expert pilots taking pilot training. You know, of course you could learn to, you know, of course you can teach somebody. It's racist to say Arabs. This is one of the great arguments that the supporters of the 9/11 official story come up with. It's racist to accuse Arabs of being stupid. It sort of guilt trips you and sort of turns the tables. It's a brilliant bit of spin. You know, so that was the argument. You know, these guys, might have been just ordinary guys. They got their flight lessons. They somehow figured out how to, you know, overcome the pilots and how to navigate. Fortunately, it was a clear day. Interesting question. What would have happened if 9/11 hadn't been a clear day? What would have happened if it had been foggy? I don't say that bears on, but people who think they've got an explanation need to consider that, I think. That was the official story. $2.3 billion, 600 sleeper cells in America. It's on record. It's quite hard to find, actually, now. We would try to research it, but I remember it very clearly. It was said. And that was the explanation. Oh, dear. 9/11 Commission. Actually, there weren't any sleeper cells in America. Maybe one. New York Times reckoned there weren't any at all when it looked at it. We'll look back 3 years later. $2.3 billion? No, you know, they were just getting $100 here and there. You know, Ziad Jarrah was begging $400 a month off his relatives. Those were the facts. That the facts have forced the official story into a position which, if they'd come up with it, imagine they'd said on 9/11, you know, well, actually, these guys were just a bunch of clowns, you know, they didn't have anybody supporting them in America, it was sheer good luck. And by the way, you know, the FBI would have stopped it if they hadn't been actively blocked by senior agents in the FBI from investigating one of the co-conspirators who they already had arrested. Just imagine what the reaction would have been then. That's why we can revisit 9/11. That's why anybody who wants to damage the war myth, damage the crown jewels of the war, of the drive to abolish the American Constitution, of the drive to occupy the Middle East and continue with 20 years, possibly 50 years, of bloodshed and mayhem, That's the question they have to answer. Why can't we possibly? That's the question Noam Chomsky has to answer. That's the question everybody has to answer. Why cannot we revisit this event? Why can't we have a proper investigation? I rest my case.
Right, we're going to have 10-15 minutes so everyone go to the toilet, go to the bar, and then he'll be taking questions along with any of us if we can help answer them. Just one point before everyone goes is, I know they've been going on about recent surveys in America. New York Times and CBS did a survey at the weekend. Only 16% of Americans actually believe the official story. 2% were unknown. Something like 28% thought they might be lying, and 58% thought they were definitely lying about 9/11. So this isn't something that's going to go away very soon.
So could I just say, if you are new to us and Belinda, you would like... Belinda's sending a...
Yeah, if you want to add to the email list, Belinda's at the back with a... Get involved, ask any questions. Unable to hear, move yourselves in a bit. There's a bit more...